In terms of CBD, you know, who knows? I've heard a million people just throw in the towel. We're done. You know, we can't do this again. Well, they probably shouldn't have done it in the first place if they couldn't afford to fail the first year. And, you know, if everybody does pull out, you know, the amount of growers is reduced. Well, it'll swing the other way. And hopefully the ones that stick with it can be rewarded.
That's Josh Leidecker, a hemp grower and mill operator from Lycoming County, Pennsylvania. This is the Lancaster Farming Industrial Hemp Podcast. My name is Eric Herlock, and today I talk to Josh about how his company, Susquehanna Hemp, is involved in grain, fiber, and CBD production. It's a wide-ranging interview. We cover all kinds of things. We really go deep on what it takes to grow grain hemp. Fascinating stuff. I think you'll learn a lot. We'll also hear from Mia Lowry, who is organizing the Keystone Hemp Conference in Lancaster County next week. And we'll check in with Lancaster Farming News editor Phil Gruber, who's working on a story about hemp's mistaken identity in Lehigh County. But first, a couple of sponsor messages. Today's show is sponsored by PA Hemporium, the Industrial Hemp Symposium at Kutztown University on Friday, March 13th, 2020, from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. You'll hear from local experts about state and federal regulations, optimum conditions for growing, new equipment for harvesting, where the market is today and where it's headed, and much more. Register before March 4th for early bird pricing. Go to pahemporium.com. This episode is sponsored by Advanced Hemp, the world's first hemp-specific fertilizing system designed to maximize yields and CBD production. At Advanced Hemp, they have a team of 25 PhD plant scientists who have been researching the plant for over 20 years, and they really know their stuff. So if you want heavy yields of high CBD hemp, feed your crops Advanced Hemp. But don't wait. Production is limited, so pre-order now at advancedhemp.com. Over the past few weeks, I've been mentioning some of these upcoming hemp events that are happening here in Pennsylvania. There's the Hemporium in Kutztown on March 13th. There's a Hempcrete workshop down in Kennett Square on March 7th. And next week, on March 4th in Lancaster, there is the Keystone Hemp Conference. I wanted to learn more about this, so I got in touch with Mia Lowry. Welcome to the Lancaster Farming Industrial Hemp Podcast. So you are one of the organizers of the Keystone Hemp Conference that's taking place, what, next week in Lancaster on March 4th?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell me about the conference, like what people can expect to get out of it and that sort of thing?
Certainly. So we put this conference together to basically serve as a strategic planning meeting or strategic planning session for farmers across Pennsylvania and surrounding states, basically to give them access to trusted industry resources and some education prior to kicking off of the season. Last year, there was a lot of deficits identified in connecting the supply chain. So our goal is to help everybody get better prepared so they can create those relationships and know who they're going to be utilizing for various reasons throughout the duration of the season, and to help them ensure success on the back end.
What is your connection to the hemp industry? How are you involved?
So I work as a consultant in the industry. My background is in healthcare risk management. And in 2017, I made the transition from healthcare to hemp and cannabis. Basically, what I do is I help to provide education and resources, as well as logistics and operations for farmers or different industry partners to, again, kind of help connect the dots. Mm-hmm. I also do a little bit of risk management planning for people as well.
Now, I noticed there's a fair amount of like hemp meetings and conferences and things happening lately. I guess this is meeting season for farmers.
Yes.
But why was it important for you to put the Keystone Hemp Conference together, and sort of what maybe sets it apart from some of the others?
Certainly. So this past year, I had the opportunity to work with a large Amish farming co-op, if you will. and doing just what I had expressed before, which was logistics and operations for them. And through this experience, we obviously reflected on things that we could improve upon, especially in terms of education and resources for the Amish community specifically. We want to, again, ensure their success and give them access to other industry partners and knowledge and information that they may not necessarily have access to. So that was kind of my driving force to put that together, as well as just bring an opportunity to kind of have more guided conversations versus lectures. So like you said, there's a lot of meetings. Everybody wants to have meetings, which I think is still very phenomenal because we're all trying to support the same initiative. But this one is a little bit different in terms of the level of engagement. So we're not looking to present our attendees with a series of lectures. We want more guided conversations and dialogue so people can really ask the right questions and get answers to the questions that they have yet to be able to do so.
Okay, sounds good. So where can people learn more about it and, you know, register?
Yes, so several ways. We did market the meeting in the Busy Beaver, so that information should be in the last two issues that went out. We do have a hotline to call and register. That phone number is 717-732-3668 if someone does not have access to online registration. We do have a website, which is KeystoneHempCon.com. You can buy tickets there. Our vendor list and our itinerary for the day is also on there, so that's a great resource. And then obviously you can certainly check us out on social media. We do have a Facebook page.
Great. Okay. I'll put the links up on the show page for this episode.
Great. Thank you.
So people can find it at LancasterFarming.com too.
Awesome. That's wonderful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Is there anything else you think listeners should know about it?
Not so much. I think it's a great opportunity. Like I said, we're really trying to be strategic this season. And given the obstacles that a lot of farmers encountered last year and a significant hesitation for new farmers to enter into the industry, we really feel that when we can get it right, and we can do it well, it shows the industry that Pennsylvania can be safe, we can be responsible, we can be compliant, and we can all be successful. So that's really what we're trying to accomplish here.
All right, great. All right, so it's the Keystone Hemp Conference, Wednesday, March 4th, from 12 to 6 at the Holiday Inn, Lancaster?
Yes.
On Chestnut Street in Lancaster City.
That's correct. Yep, we have a great group of vendors. We do have some equipment that will be showcased there as well. So a great lineup of speakers on various topics. So we're hopeful to see everybody there.
Okay, great. All right, thanks, Mia Lowry from the Keystone Hemp Conference.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Eric.
Okay, before we get into the interview with Josh Lidecker, Susquehanna Hemp, I wanted to check in with my Lancaster Farming colleague, Phil Gruber. He's working on a story that sort of underscores a major issue, major oversight here at the state level in Pennsylvania concerning industrial hemp. Industrial hemp is technically illegal here in Pennsylvania because it's never been removed from the state list of controlled substances. So anyway, we'll let Phil explain it to you. So you are working on a hemp-related story out of Lehigh County. Can you explain what's been going on up there and what you've learned?
Yeah, so last May, a father and son ran into some trouble with the state police. They were busted for having material that had THC in it. And so this father and son, Kenneth and Jason Grossman, were starting a hemp business, CBD products. Kenneth, at least, spent some time in jail last year. But on February 19th, Jason, the son, pleaded no contest to drug possession charges, while Kenneth, the father, charges were dropped against him. I should say, too, that this was, as far as we know, everything was a hemp product. Nothing was actually marijuana. The material did have traces of THC, as you would expect.
0.3.
But at those legal levels. So the thing is, you know, when the federal farm bill legalized hemp, you know, hemp was taken off of the controlled substances list at the federal level. Mm-hmm. But when Pennsylvania legalized hemp, the state didn't allow for that 0.3% in its own Controlled Substances Act. Hmm. So technically speaking, the state still has a zero tolerance policy toward THC on the books.
And that's a potential problem for all Pennsylvania hemp farmers.
Yeah, and the hemp advocacy groups like the Hemp Industry Council are definitely concerned about it. They're pushing a bill, Senate Bill 936, and that would basically clear up this loophole.
Okay. And so this is a story that you're working on for what, this Saturday's paper?
Yes. So it'll be available in the paper and online.
Cool. Thanks for your reporting on this. This is an issue that we've brought up on the podcast before, and it's definitely something that hemp farmers need to be paying attention to.
Yeah. It is interesting. The bill was only introduced in November. It does have a couple influential supporters. Those include Senator Judy Schwank, who, of course, is a big hemp advocate out of Berks County. There's Pat Brown, who's the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. He's a Republican, as well as Jay Costa, the Democratic minority leader in the Senate.
All right. Phil Gruber, news editor at Lancaster Farming. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. Our next guest is Josh Leidecker from Susquehanna Hemp and Susquehanna Mills up there in Lycoming County. He's been on the show before. I think the first time was last March. Great guy to talk to, very knowledgeable. He's kind of a leader in the industry. He's a pioneer in Pennsylvania as far as hemp goes. And I learn a lot every time I talk to him, and I hope you do too. All right, here we go. Josh Leidecker, welcome back to the Lancaster Farming Industrial Hemp Podcast. How you doing?
I'm great. Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Can you sort of refresh us, reintroduce yourself? You know, where are you from? What are you up to? Who are you?
Sure. Well, again, I'm Josh Leidecker. I'm from central Pennsylvania, Lycoming County. We have an oil seed mill called Susquehanna Mills, where we process, extract oil seed products, both meal and oil. And we make culinary food oil from the oil side. And then we make non-GMO, non-soy feed ingredients from the leftover bits of the oil seeds.
Okay.
And we also have Susquehanna Hemp Company, which was, the two are connected, of course, but my bank was pretty adamant about having us separate the two. So we have two separate entities, one for the hemp side, and then obviously one for the agricultural food side.
So you were one of the like early Pennsylvania pioneers in hemp. You know, you got in, what, on the first year of having a hemp permit?
Yep. 17. Yep. We were, I believe, the first to plant in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
I think we were the first to plant in Limestoneville, which is about 20 minutes from our current location. And, you know, we grew hemp on that farm this year as well. So all 3 years we've stayed on that particular piece of property.
Cool. Can you tell me how your hemp operation has changed as you head into this 2020 season?
Sure. Of course, we've always been involved in all three disciplines of hemp. You know, we started out from the oil seed side, which is still kind of, you know, the most important part of this whole thing for us. Last year, we dove into fiber substantially with Groff North American, and we grew 140 acres of fiber, which was a great learning experience and pretty excited to hopefully continue some of that stuff this year with a couple other groups that are involved in the industry. And then CBD, I had intentions on growing a little bit of CBD on my own farm just because we use it as a family and we do have a small CBD brand. And that kind of got out of control a little bit last year. We ended up kind of putting a bunch of farms under our permit and kind of guiding them through the process of growing CBD. And we ended up growing about 14 acres of CBD.
Wow.
Obviously helped, like we contributed to the oversupply issue in Pennsylvania. So we're doing our part, you know? Yeah. So I guess this year you asked the question, like, what are we planning on doing? And as we're sitting here trying to put together our plan for the year, we're just, you know, there's 100% going into, you know, this business plan. So we're trying to divide up kind of where we stand. And I think we've kind of settled on the fact that we're going to focus 80% of our efforts on fiber and grain and 20% of our efforts on CBD. I want to give up on CBD yet, because I think there still is a potential there. It's just, we're waiting for kind of the industry to level out and find its, you know, kind of happy place where farmers can make reasonable dollars and processors can as well, you know? So mm-hmm. that's kind of where we're still going to grow some CBD, probably not add any acreage, if anything, probably cut back some acreages, but we're going to continue that piece of it.
And you're not putting all of your eggs in the hemp basket. You've got some other diverse things going on up there, right? Can you talk a little bit about what else you grow, what else you mill?
Oh, sure. So we have kind of like settled on non-GMO oilseed, you know, food oils and meal, of course. And it's really started to develop really, really in a wonderful way the last few years, where, you know, kind of people's view on food has been changing and, you know, kind of, you know, look towards sustainability and local sourcing and obviously the non-soy piece, you know, the non-GMO piece, all of those things has been kind of critical. And we were already doing that. It wasn't cool when we started, but it's become kind of the thing to do. So our business on that end has grown, you know, exponentially. This last year wasn't quite as aggressive because we bought a new building and didn't focus on sales as much. But the last few years we've had, you know, near almost 24% growth for 3 years. And then last year we were only about 12% growth, but we did move and spent a lot of energy and effort and time on the new facility. So I'm going to attribute that to why we didn't continue that growth this year. But absolutely, that's the main focus of kind of my efforts, is don't forget about the thing that pays your bills. And that's, you know, that's the part that really has made sense. Not that we didn't do fairly well in the hemp scene last year. We did very well, I think, in consideration with some of these other folks, but it's still, you know, it's still one of those things. We're going to continue doing it because we're in it, but we're not going to forget about, you know, why we do what we do to begin with. So
So you mentioned the oversupply, and, you know, there's sort of been a lot of doom and gloom in the hemp space lately after the 2019 season. What do you see as some of the bright spots in the hemp industry these days?
Well, you know, obviously CBD pushed because of the promise of all of this big, big money, but we never lost focus of the other parts. So I'm not sure if I can talk about it yet, but there's a group getting together now with the National Hemp Association and New Holland Agriculture. And they've set aside a pretty good chunk of cash to devote towards developing the fiber market here in the Northeast. I'm not sure how official all of that is coming, but I've heard of some realistic numbers. We actually have, we're excited about that, and we're trying to keep that. We don't have any guarantee on any kind of production takeoff agreements or anything yet, but we're still going to plant quite a bit of grain. Dual purpose hemp, field hemp this year, in anticipation of one of these things popping off. Either the fiber thing makes sense, and if that is the case, we would cut early and harvest that fiber, and hopefully those markets develop a little bit further, and that would be really, really good. Or if that doesn't develop as fast, we also have some really exciting things happening now in the grain end. Specifically, the seed itself and all of the byproducts of the seed for food products. We're developing a snack line with a major snack producer here in Pennsylvania, which is utilizing both the flour, the oil, and just the whole roasted seeds, which is really exciting, because that kind of makes it attainable to everybody. You know, someday you could go into the gas station and right next to the cash register might be little packages of roasted PA hemp seeds, which could be delicious and healthy and wonderful, and pretty excited about that. you know, that's going to be kind of a neat thing coming up. And I think it's going to happen pretty quick. The snack producer has some West Coast markets that are really, really pushing them hard to get into this space. So I see some synergies with what they're trying to do alongside of what we're trying to do and just really develop markets for those products. That, and also we're involved in several research projects now utilizing the meal as an animal feed.
Right.
Now, currently, it's not approved as an animal feed, so a lot of this is experimental.
Right.
But the fact that there is enough of this going on kind of gives me some comfort, I guess, in the fact that there is going to be a market for the grain. The grain is not for everyone to grow. I mean, it is a intense, not necessarily on the growing side, but the harvesting, cleaning, and drying is really super critical. So it's not for every farmer. It has to be kind of that, that farmer that really can kind of pay attention to details and is prepared to do what he must to ensure that the grain is held in a good condition.
Can you talk about what it takes to harvest and dry the grain?
Well, I can. Yeah, sure. So one of the issues is that this it's indeterminate. So when you harvest the hemp grain, the hemp plant is still alive. So it's not like your typical crops where, wheat is completely dead. It's dried down. It's brown. There's no living space. It just basically there it is. And you wait till you get your appropriate moisture content in your grain and you cut it. Hemp continues to grow. And it will, so at the time of harvest, you may have seeds on that plant that are green. You may have seeds that are falling off on the ground because they're completely ripe. And you have, all of the other, ages of seeds in the middle. So mm-hmm. there might be some that are higher moisture, some that are lower moisture, some that are immature, all of these things. So one of the challenges with harvesting grain hemp is being prepared to condition that grain immediately, because it's coming off at anywhere between 18 and 22% moisture. So with all oil seeds, heating of grain is extra important with an oil seed than it is with like a conventional cereal grain, where if you have too much moisture, it will heat very, very quickly. So in other words, if we need to have somebody prepared to harvest a crop, go ahead and run that crop through a cleaner right off the cuff, because unfortunately, we do not have a host of chemical options for weed control. So if you happen to have a bad year with later water, kind of like we did last year, you're going to have a lot of weeds that come up in that crop. And those would need to be separated out immediately off the truck. And then that grain would need to be conditioned, with a dryer pretty quickly, because it will heat if it has a chance to sit in a truck. And I would say even overnight, I've cut sunflowers before that were, say, 13% moisture, and they were getting warm even after sitting in a truck for 12 hours overnight.
So what's the ideal moisture content?
Well, we like to process things here between 7 and 8% moisture. So I think storage would be safe under 10, but really for processing, we're looking for a 7 to 8% moisture content.
Okay.
So it takes that certain kind of farmer that has that attention to detail, has that equipment, has that capacity, has the manpower to kind of like see it all the way through until it's safe and able to be stored for a long term.
Okay. So what types of farmers that are sort of out there now would be sort of prepared to pivot to hemp?
For grain hemp?
Yeah.
So grain hemp, someone who has on-site storage and the ability to clean grain. And not everyone is like that anymore. With all of the elevators that are accepting, corn, wheat, soybeans at whatever condition you bring in, has kind of made it not a complete necessity to store grain on farm anymore. Mm-hmm. So it has to be the sort of farmer that has obviously equipment that he feels comfortable cutting a crop like hemp, has the kind of the will to do it because it could potentially not go well for him. And has the equipment to like immediately deal with it right off. So out of the field into the combine, out of the combine into a truck, out of the truck into a cleaner to take away as much of that that green leafy material and whatnot that might happen to be in it, weed seeds, all of those details, and then get it on a floor so it can be dried, either a stationary kind of bin dryer, or we used a batch dryer. We had a rotary batch dryer that we used last year. And then one of my friends had another larger, it's like a homemade thing, but basically it was a continuous flow dryer. And to get that stuff dried to a safe condition as quickly as possible so it maintains the quality of the grain, because we really are heading towards food grade sort of applications for this grain. So it really needs to be cared for.
What should hemp farmers be thinking about now, you know, in your opinion? Here it is in what, mid to late winter 2020. Where should these farmers' heads be at right now?
Well, I mean, I wish I had a set true answer, but really establishing relationships with people that can take these products. And there isn't really that many. You know, I heard, I got a letter from Groff said they were no longer going to, they were not going to contract fiber for this year. I don't think they're out of the game. I think they're just trying to catch up with what happened last year. So right now there's not a current takeoff agreement for fiber. For grain, I mean, I'm a processor, but I don't know what the market is going to be. So it's going to be really hard for me to say to, you know, farmer XYZ, hey, I'll take your grain and I'll pay you this much for it, because I really don't know where it's going to go. So it's got to be the sort of farmer that's really has kind of the stomach for diving into the unknown. Because it can be expensive and challenging, and without really knowing specifically where, you know, legislation is going to land and what regulation is going to look like this year. And it's going to change dramatically. And it's already changed dramatically, and I expect it to change several times again before we really settle on where we are. So I think for hemp farmers, they're really going to have a commitment to see this thing through and kind of like a longer term vision. It's really not a short term play. It's a longer term thing. So that's kind of my perspective there. In terms of CBD, you know, who knows? I've heard a million people just throw in the towel. We're done. You know, we can't do this again. Well, they probably shouldn't have done it in the first place if they couldn't afford to, you know, to fail the first year. So we've got, you know, there's a lot of guys out there that gained experience in CBD. And, you know, what I'm telling my guys, my growers, is that, you know, we learned an awful lot last year. And, you know, if everybody does pull out and, you know, the amount of growers is reduced, well, it'll swing the other way. And hopefully the ones that stick with it can be rewarded next year. So, I mean, that's kind of my advice to anybody coming to me wanting to grow CBD this year is, you know, number one, if you can't afford to lose the input cost, don't do it. You know, if you can afford to lose $5,000, spend $5,000. If you can't, then don't grow, you know, hemp, don't try CBD, because who knows what's going to happen. You know, it seems like the end product market is still very, very strong. It's just going to take a little bit of time for the processing to catch up to the middle, you know, and those markets to kind of settle. And I don't know that they're ever going to reach those insane numbers of last fall, you know, those, you know, $4-5 a percentage point, but you know, it's still going to be a specialty crop. And I think that specialty crop will still demand a fairly high rate of return because it is specialty. And if it's done correctly, it should be valuable. And I think that there is a place for it, but I don't think it's going to be at those numbers, you know, again. Okay. I could be wrong. I've been wrong once.
So I see that in a couple of weeks you are speaking at the Pennsylvania Hemporium. This is on March 13th at Kutztown University in Berks County. And I see that you're listed on talking about the state of the market and taking products to market. And then a little later in the day, you're going to be talking about selecting genetics and understanding COAs. So maybe we can just go over that stuff briefly, but what is the state of the market and what's some advice for taking products to market?
Well, the state of the market is Well, I do not have a crystal ball. We have looked at every single opportunity that comes across us, and some are very, very real, and some are still, you know, there's a bunch of people out there trying to scam good, hardworking farmers, which kind of ticks me off. But so the State of the Union is certainly in flux, and I think it's going to be ever changing. And to think that it's going to be one thing is foolish. I do think that it's going to continue to modify itself, change, make adjustments as, you know, the true volume of supply shows itself, because a lot of that has not really been completely quantified. You know, I think that people, a lot of people grew hemp, and I think there was good hemp and there was bad hemp. And I think there's, which we're finding now, like we're finding that, you know, people, processors are not equipped to deal with, you know, pesticide residue or in their hemp. So who knows how much of that hemp was grown will be immediately consumed by this market as the market develops. So I don't really have a good answer for the state of this market or this industry, except I do think it's going to continue, and I think it's going to be adjusting. And I think that people have to look at it as a long game and not a short game, and plan in that perspective, you know. In terms of like preparing for market, like that's the next bit, is to, you got to think of your crop in the eyes of the processor now, instead of you got it out of the field and you have all of this work put into it and you have all of these things done and you're exhausted with the whole thing. And, you know, even with the experience that we have, and I would say it's substantial, you know, we were shocked by, you know, some of how our initial crops were received. You know, like for instance, we went to a new processor with our first load of hemp. I was excited. We were the first load of hemp to go into this processor. And of course, throughout the entire season, we're testing for cannabinoids to keep the regulatory side in check and also try to maximize our return, you know, by keeping our CBD contents as high as possible. Yeah. But when it came to processing, you had another layer of things that they had to deal with. So heavy metals, for example, pesticide residues, things that you weren't prepared for because you weren't thinking of them while you were processing, while you were growing this crop, but clearly became an issue, and not necessarily because they couldn't be managed, because they certainly can be managed, but it's just the fear of the unknown. So a new processor that hasn't had the experience with dealing with remediation of heavy metals or pesticide contents or something like that, you know, they're afraid of anything new. So when that sort of stuff was discovered, all of a sudden there was like a, oh my goodness, what are we going to do to kind of best manage this? And there was a bit of growth there from that first processor that I'm referring to. I've also sold product to another processor that was a little more experienced in other parts of the country. Metals were absolutely not an issue, but pesticide residue was. So like in terms of like getting your product ready for market, the best bet is to like aggregate it into volumes that work for processors. So like 1,000 or 2,000 pounds in a lot, and then aggregate that material from that lot, and then have not a full panel of tests done, but you know, obviously, you know, cannabinoids are important, moisture is important, heavy metals is important, pesticide residue is important. And, you know, to some degree, depending on how it's processed and what the end use is how intricate that you need to get. Like, for instance, the smokable market, which is kind of this weird unknown thing that I have trouble wrestling. I do feel like that needs to be held to a higher standard, because if people are going to be consuming hemp, you know, directly into their bodies, you really need to know, you know, is there an issue with it? Did it happen to have a mold or something like that could harm people? that stuff kind of scares me in a very unregulated sort of world where there's a lot of, I mean, you've heard these stories of people selling hemp all over the place for whatever, you know, so if you have mold in your hemp, for example, you know, that really should go through extraction. There should be no other option. There should not be another market that that should go to, but there's no guideline to how your product needs to be. You know, you just have to figure it out, and everybody's hunting for money. So, you know, if somebody comes along and says, I'll buy 100 pounds of this for smokable, and they have money, people take it and they go. And even though it may not be the best thing for the end market, that's happening all over the place. So I think a little bit, a better view on like, kind of like the testing in relationship to the end product is the most important thing. So in other words, if you're going to go, you know, say you've got super, all these heavy metals, pesticide residues, mold, all this stuff, maybe that product should go through into an isolate product instead of a full spec product,
yeah, sure.
You know, or, you know, that's kind of the guidance that I hope that I can share like with the Department of Ag when it's time. I'd love to, you know, they've asked me to come be a part of this, the hemp steering committee. And I'm hoping that I can, you know, add the farmer's perspective and some of the challenges that we're running into. And hopefully in the next few years, we can really develop, you know, some sort of regulation that works for everybody, you know, and really, you know, kind of pinpoints how we can produce really high quality things within that regulation.
The other thing you're going to be talking about at this Hemporium on March 13th is selecting genetics and understanding COAs. Now, I don't want to like steal your thunder or whatever, but can you give us like a couple of nuggets of what you might be talking about there?
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, and the COA is basically, it's a guide. It's not an end till you're at the end. It's kind of, yeah, I think we're going to talk about how the COAs are used through the whole production of hemp. In other words, there's a time where the only thing that matters is when you're going to harvest and to keep your product federally compliant, as well as trying to maximize your CBD content. You know, there's going to be times where you're now merchandising a product and a COA needs to be read differently at that time and maybe have a little more intricate look into some of the other things that need to be tested for that part, you know. And then on the back end, I mean, the final products is incredibly important, you know, from the crude to the distillate to whatever end up product that you end up making. The COAs have a different kind of importance at different times during this process. So I think that's pretty critical to understand what to be looking for and then also to be budgeting for. You know, testing can be really expensive. We carried the burden of testing for all of our growers this year, and it's not a small number. It was a pretty expensive adventure. So I think that needs to be considered is not to overtest, test when you need to test and test to be most effective. So yeah, I think I won't get into details of what we're looking for on all those COAs, but that's kind of going to be the structure of that part of the discussion. And then in terms of genetics, I mean, I think that we're so early in the development of this industry that I do think that there are some safer bets, you know, in terms of genetics, but I don't know that there's any one solid answer. There's not going to be a direct answer. So at least not for a few years. I think that technology is possible. And I think that as long as regulation allows, you know, the growing pains to kind of grow into where it needs to be, I think we'll get there. But genetics are a tough one. You know, it's you know, you can be 100% sure of nothing. It's really what it comes down to. I was privy to some of the test results on even fiber and grain genetics where, you know, you have the potential of getting a hot test on some of those. And that's a big challenge, but see, those need to be regulated in a different perspective. So like, you know, the THC content of a grain genetic, you know, there'll be a point where it peaks, but then it's going to drop back off as the grain is produced. So your end product, you know, shouldn't be governed by how it tests midstream, you know?
Right.
Yeah, genetics are a tough one. I mean, I have an opinion on that, and I'm going to try to kind of be the best resource as possible. So I'm going to reach out to some of my industry peers so I can really kind of bring not just my opinion, but several opinions to the table and offer that information during this talk.
Anything else you want to share with our listeners about what's going on in Josh Land?
No. I mean, we're looking at just kind of making agriculture as satisfying as possible and trying to support the growth of all different sort of directions and not your typical what's always been done. Like, we don't grow standard things. We always grow oddball things. And
what are some of the weirdest seed oils that you press?
Well, I grew, I had a friend that went down to Louisiana, and there is apparently some sort of tree that makes a seed that is just everywhere, very prevalent down there. And I don't recall what the name of this was, but he brought it back up and he said, "Hey, I need you to crush this stuff." And it was the weirdest thing. It was such a saturated oil, like it would go through the extraction mill. And as soon as it came out of the sieve of the head where the oil drips out, it would drip, but it would turn solid before it hit the beaker that was underneath it.
Whoa.
It was really strange. Yeah, it was high, like incredibly saturated. And it was an interesting project, but I have all the time people are bringing me stuff to process. I have some sort of bitter hickory nut that came from Kentucky in the shop now that needs to be processed. I've crushed pecan bits. I had a farmer in South Carolina or North Carolina, wherever they grow pecans, send me up a whole bunch of like broken pecan bits to crush, which was kind of exciting. And it was a byproduct for him, so he was trying to utilize it to make a higher quality or a better quality side of, you know, side product line from it. That was kind of cool. But yeah, we're always looking. We've got a project where we're going to plant some oilseed pumpkins this year, which is kind of exciting. When I was traveling in Austria and Germany a couple of years ago, I saw a harvesting device which was designed for picking up oilseed pumpkins and smashing them and collecting the seeds, but throwing the rest back out in the field. It was pretty cool. And we sell to a lot of really high-end restaurants, and they're always looking for other interesting things. So pumpkin seed oil is certainly one of those that I think we could make something pretty neat about, you know?
Yeah, you're crushing it up there, huh?
Yeah, literally, I guess, yeah. Yeah, we're currently winterizing some sunflower oil right now. That's kind of today's mission for our retail line, which I think I did post some interesting things on our Facebook page about that, which is kind of neat. And we are also, I just took another load of biomass over to a lab in Scranton to extract. And I posted some videos on our Susquehanna Hemp Company page showing some of that, which was kind of cool. I think it's important that people kind of understand what it takes to go through all this stuff. It's not just, you know, it's not just simple. There's lots of steps to it. So that's what I'm trying to do. And I had permission from them to share those, which a lot of places don't like that, don't want to do that sort of thing.
I will put links to that stuff on the show page for this episode so listeners can go check it out.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Sure.
All right. Well, Josh Leidecker,
yeah.
Thank you for your time today.
Well, thanks for talking with me.
All right, well, that pretty much does it for me. Thanks for listening. My name is Eric Herlock. I am the digital editor at Lancaster Farming Newspaper. Thank you to Mia Lowry and Josh Leidecker and Phil Gruber for joining me today. If you have questions or comments, feel free to email me at podcast@lancasterfarming.com. Check us out online, lancasterfarming.com. Be sure to find the show page for this episode there, and you'll get all kinds of links and additional information. So, okay, until next time, I'll see you in the newspaper. This episode of the Lancaster Farming Industrial Hemp Podcast is copyright 2020 by Lancaster Farming, which is part of Steinman Communications. Today's show was written and recorded, edited, and produced by Eric Herlock. The music you hear throughout the show is courtesy of Tin Bird Shadow, including the music in the ads. How about that?
Industrial hemp.